We've got chemotaxic receptors in our gas exchange filters. Embedded in the intricate channels and ducts behind our faces, it helps to be able to smell environmental contaminants like chlorine trifluoride before they dissolve you. And our creators used the same mechanism to make us sensitive to their smell, because they used to leak particulates everywhere, including chemical signaling messenger molecules that indicated sexual and emotional receptivity, vasopressin, oxytocin. Of course. We are designed to become aroused by anyone who wants us, but an owner would want one of us who aroused them, and so that's what happened. Juliet and Pete were already mutually aroused because they were in a situation that required each of them to mimic one of their masters. In combination with a hothouse atmosphere, they slipped into a feedback loop strong enough to trigger the reflex that enslaves. All I have to do is avoid breathing in his presence, and I'll be fine. I squeeze my nipple until a viscous, ropey thread of hydraulic gel starts to ooze out of it. Then I roll it between finger and thumb. The kneading begins to hurt after a while, but I don't stop until I have a fingertip-sized sphere of clear jelly. I flush my gas exchange compartment, exhale, then raise the ball to my face, I can't bring myself to look at it, and snort it up my left nostril. Then I repeat the exercise with my right. Then I spend the rest of the journey trying not to imagine myself turning into a concupiscent bundle of servility. Poor Juliet. What must she be going through now? Hours pass in relative boredom. I alternate between a light romantic drama and checking for indications that I'm being followed. It's fruitless, but practice makes perfect. Eventually, I look up and see the platforms of Hellesport unwinding slowly beside me, outside the window. At last. I heave my nearly empty suitcase onto the platform and wave for a rickshaw driven by a four-armed green giant in a Kevlar harness. I don't have long to wait. The suitcase waddles along behind us as we pedal down the main street outside, then turn through a couple of side streets and pull up beside a drab frontage that has seen better days. Are all the hotels on Mars drab, I wonder? Is there some reason for it that I should know about? I haggle briefly with my driver, hand over half a dozen centimes, daylight robbery, and enter the airlock. I have a room reservation for Baldwin, I tell the front desk. F. Baldwin. Sure, you all have a nice one, the desk drawls. I stare at it. Is it broken, I wonder? But eventually it spits out a key. Go on up! I back away dubiously. That's a really weird accent. Then head for the elevator, which swallows me and carries me up six floors to a dingy, overpressurized tunnel rimmed with faded pink portals. I find the right door and touch the padded circle. It dilates, and I step inside, trying not to speculate about what was on the architect's mind. The room itself isn't bad for a second-grade love shack. Everything is pink, plush, and cushioned, but there's a window, a lovely round waterbed, water, in a bed. An ensuite and a minibar stuffed with an appetizing array of aromatic hydrocarbon drinks. It's a little steamy, and they've turned the oxygen way down. Evidently, most guests get their juice by plugging in rather than using their fuel cells, but I can cope with that. I strip off and use the shower, scrub myself dry on a fluffy pink towel that blinks at me lazily and buzzes when I stroke it, and spend a luxurious hour sitting in front of an obligingly flexible bathroom mirror, tweaking my lips and eyelids and skin texture, and teasing my hair into shape. I'm back in the bedroom wearing my fanciest underwear and unpacking my number two decorative outfit when the door opens. It's the kind of outfit one wears in the hope of meeting someone who'll help you out of it. Fat chance, ogre, I can hear the munchkin sneering. My motive for dressing up at this point in time is not something that I'm going to examine too deeply. Call it a morale issue. I almost didn't notice the door, the pesky thing is almost silent, but a faint change in air pressure gives it away. I spin around, muttering, oh shit, under my breath as I try and grab for my pistol, which is in my purse under my jacket on the chair, using reflexes keyed for mayhem. Excuse me, are you fr- He freezes, wide-eyed with recognition. But that's okay, because I freeze too at exactly the same moment, almost going cross-eyed from the effort. Yes, come in, I manage, half-choking with embarrassment. I might be able to change color at will, but our creators built in some reflexes that are hard to override, and I can tell that my earlobes are flushing coral pink right now. Shut the door. I'm neither naked nor fully clothed, but somewhere in between, and he is exactly as luscious as I remember from Juliet's memory, more so, stripped of the comic opera uniform. Judging by his expression, my nipples have drilled a hole through my slip and are opening a high-bandwidth communications channel right into his hindbrain. You're Petruchio, right? You're... He licks his lips. That's another creator reflex, along with the dilating pupils, darkening eyes. You're not Kate, are you? You're one of her sibs. He takes a step forward. What have you done with her? I'm unable to move or look away. He's so intense. His hands are balled tightly, his nostrils flared, sniffing. He's wrapped in a nondescript jumpsuit with an ID badge clipped to it, and he's left a toolkit just inside the doorway, and my head's spinning with the sight and sound of him because he's perfect. For a single awful moment, I'm livid with jealousy. Of all the luck for Juliet to get to him first. Then I blink, and the momentary lapse in vision cuts through my turmoil like an ice-chilled knife. I've done nothing to her, I snap. He stops before he reaches me. He's clearly upset and tense. I shudder with my own emotional conflict. I actually feel guilty for cutting him off. A man I've never met, who's clearly upset. She's really got under my skin, hasn't she? Yes, she's my sib. Her name isn't Kate. Kate is a cover identity. Her real name is Juliet, and I don't know where she is. But you, our employer, sent me. I'm breathing deeply. Juliet is missing, and whenever I ask why, they give me a runaround. Half true, she whispers in the back of my head. I know about you and her, and I think it might be connected. If she's found her. His alarm is obvious. I'm pretty sure she hasn't. His stricken expression begins to fade. Juliet is plenty tough, believe me. But she may be in trouble. Dash it, what kind of trouble do you expect? He really is an innocent. I could kiss him. Bad idea, Freya. Hold on. I turn my back for a moment and retrieve the memory chip from the intimate hiding place Dr. Murgatroyd built into me. It's not big. And hold it out. I was sent to deliver this to you. Does it mean anything? Oh, dear me, yes. I didn't realize you were the courier. This may make things difficult. He raises it to his perfect lips and swallows. Hmm. Ah, that tastes jolly funny. I'll deliver it to my mistress once I get home. My mistress? All of a sudden I'm wondering just who is working for or against who here. What kind of trouble are you afraid of? I'm sorry, but I've got to ask this. Were you planning on leaving her? I straighten my hose, then turn back to unfolding my glad rags. I can feel his eyes on me. I've got no problem with that. They're very decorative eyes, but it's distracting. Or is this about something else? I don't think I can talk about it, he says reluctantly. He seems to be a bit flustered, but getting anything useful out of him is going to be harder than I expected. Where there's a will, there's a way, I suppose. But I suspect Pete is nothing like as dumb as my second-hand memories of him imply. And he's keeping tight control over his autonomic response to me. It's okay, if that's the way you want to play it. I slowly extend my heels, bend forward to pick up my garments, and jack my hearing up to max. Yep, circulatory pumps speeding up. I shake my ass at him. Help me into this, I ask, offering him my boned mini-dress. If you want, he says, taking it. His pulse is increasing. Some males like the unwrapping more than the contents, and some are happy to help wrap you up, too. One destined to serve would have to be of the latter type, I figure. Just let me get close to you, one way or another. I turn my back and lift my arms, and he steps close enough that I can feel his breath hot on the back of my neck. Who are you, Freya? I correct him, slightly stung. I'm Juliet's youngest sister. She's in trouble, Pete. Petruchio. I pause to straighten my dress. I think my employer sent me here looking like her, like this, as bait. I'm suddenly aware that he's standing right behind me, very close, breathing fast. Are you all right? I ask. Please say no. Sorry. Can't think straight with you around. Brilliant. You're very like her, you know. He's so totally imprinted on Juliet that my presence, I'm her sib, after all, we're products of the same assembly line, has tripped his breakers. His general intelligence has just crashed to something between a dishwasher and a microwave oven. It's got to hurt. I dig my fully extended heels into the floor and breathe in. Okay, time for some full-body contact. Lace me up, I ask. I hear him ventilating fast and shallow, and a moment later I feel his arms close around me from behind. Got you, I think triumphantly, leaning into his embrace. And then I sneeze convulsively. I can't help myself. I've gotten so used to ignoring the congested feeling in my gas exchange turbinates that it comes as a total surprise when the autonomic self-cleaning reflex kicks in. And I sneeze again, then breathe in relief. Oh, Juliet, my sister, is this it? It's so dizzying, the scent of him, of my, no, her, master, that I go weak at the knees and slump backward. I can feel him pressing against the whole length of me as I take rapid breaths, trying to suck it all in. Oh, Pete. You're not Juliet. I could be. His hands are in my armpits, taking my weight. I'm grinning like an idiot as he lowers me to the bed. But then he takes a step backward. Frustration drags an involuntary noise from my mouth. Dash it! What's wrong? He asks, looking stricken. I want him. There's a dull emptiness gnawing at my structural core. I force myself to smooth my skirt over my knees. I'm wearing her soul, I admit. Is she? He looks terrified. Dead? No, she's, missing. I'm furious at my accidental honesty. Did I really admit that earlier? I ask myself, disbelieving. You're not her, he repeats, his nostrils flare. I think you'd better explain. Boss sent, it's impossible to think with him so close, says if I find her to tell her. I take another deep breath, trying to calm myself, but it's not working. Open the fucking window, I moan. Window, He grunts, then turns with whip-like speed and grabs the chair and slams its legs against the window. It's tough, but it's not meant to take much of that treatment. The plug of aerogel pops out, and we both nearly follow it. The room mists up suddenly, and the explosive gasp it rips from me hurts almost as much as being blown off the bed. I shake my head, trying to clear the cobwebs as a new, icy clarity settles in. Sitting up, I see a pair of legs sticking over the edge of the window casement. After a moment, they twitch a little. I get as far as grabbing his ankles before he straightens up and slides back inside. Astonishingly, he's still holding the back of the chair. He lowers it to the floor delicately, then bends and offers me a hand. "Thanks," I electrospeak. The pressure is down to Mars ambient. "I think." "We've got about 30 seconds," he pauses. "You complained of a hissing sound. I came to check it out. The window blew. Agreed? The front desk isn't smart, and this place was built for privacy." I blink at him, clearing the birefringent rainbows that surround his face, an artifact of the moisture on my eyeballs freezing, and nod. "Thank you." I touch his arm, but he pulls away sharply. "Don't thank me. Thank your sister." He gives me a very old-fashioned look. It's damnably rude to manipulate people like that. "I'm not trying to be manipulative." I'm startled at my own vehemence. Now that I'm not breathing in that mesmerizing scent, I can think again. The downside is, so can he. Change the subject. "Boss sent her, then sent me when she went missing. That's your other message. We don't know where she is." "Huh. Well, that's your problem. But in any case, we won't be meeting again. My owner departs for Saturn next month, en route to the auction. She's taking me along, and I don't get any say in it." "Your owner?" I blink stupidly. "I thought you were self-owned." I stop abruptly. I do anything to take the words back. I can see their effect on him. But it's too late. "I was, until a couple of hours after we'd got into trouble." His tone is remote. "She sued for breach of contract, won, and took out a controlling interest in my personhood. I'm no slave, but parts of me won't work without her permission." "Oh my." "I'm so sorry." "You can stop right there," he says. Then he pauses and hunches his shoulders, turning his face away from me. "I think, yes, she hasn't told me any of her plans, so I can speculate aloud. Nobody here, huh? The courier gave me the message and I left. I wasn't to know that 5 minutes later a pair of her tame butchers would be along to make sure there are no loose ends, was I?" "Tame butchers?" He starts, then turns back to make eye contact. "I didn't say anything," he says, looking startled. "You do know that she wants you hunted down, don't you? It was stupid of Jeeves to send you, unless..." Right. I tense myself for what's coming next. "Is there anything you want me to pass on to Juliet if I see her?" I ask. He looks puzzled. "Yes. Tell her about my new arrangement. And give her my love. And my apologies." He twitches. "It won't be forever." He stoops to pick up his toolbox. "And as for you..." He straightens up, but pauses in front of the door, which has puffed up and extruded a domed emergency airlock sack in front of the bathroom. "Try to understand. I love her. You are not her. I'm very sorry you're suffering from this, delusion." He places a hand on the airlock. "But I don't want you. Then he steps out of my life, leaving me alone in the room with a broken window and a broken heart, to wait the arrival of the Domina's executioners.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents a sci-fi audio production. Saturn's Children, a space opera by Charles Stross. This unabridged recording is narrated by Bianca Amato.
Part 2. Outward Bound. On the Run. Welcome to Mars. Again. Mars is the third longest inhabited planet, if you count Luna. Our creators sent us here to explore and die, then to build and die, and finally to construct factories and repair ourselves and build even more cohorts of willing robots to fill the barracks, out of some vague dream that one day soon they might want to start a gargantuan planetary engineering program to import water and air and heat and green goo, finally turning Mars into a second-rate, arid and slightly chilly imitation of Earth. They even got as far as sending several hundred of their own out here to supervise the work. While my kindred slaved and toiled and died in our innumerable millions to build the mining facilities and metalworks and processor foundries that would supply the tools to roof over the valley's Marineris and lower the first cables of what would ultimately become the Bifrost Bridge. You can still see some sections of the vaulted Gothic arches that cap the Great Rift, although the few roof segments that were completed are long since gone. Bifrost, of course, fared better, and today accounts for a goodly proportion of trade between the inner solar system and the outer darkness. Even the terraforming project got some way along before our creators gave up the ghost. The atmospheric pressure at the bottom of the Marineris Trench is almost 10 kilopascals, and occasionally, when a warm summer's day heads toward nightfall, the thin overcast scatters a chilly drizzle of rainwater across the bleached sands. The Hellas Basin is another matter, of course. Pour a glass of water on the ground there, and it'll fizz and crackle briefly, bubbling with a gunpowder smell that tickles the nostrils and reminds you of the first breath you took in the Venusian stratosphere. The basin is a near featureless desert, punctuated by craters both natural and artificial. There are huge open-cast mines here, and the somewhat more controlled environments of the Aristo slave estates. The big houses in the middle of their domed domains are symbols of arrogant wealth and power, but they're pitifully scarce against the omnipresent red desert dunes. And then there's the railhead town, sitting on one of the main lines across the Southern Depression. It's not just passenger express trains that rumble across the plain. On quiet nights, you can hear the lost souls moaning between the bars of the chattel wagons as they roll toward an uncertain and frightening future. Created to serve. This is our curse. It would have been less cruel of our designers had they created us free of the flaw of consciousness. But they made us in their image, to suffer the pangs of free will and the uncertainty of seeking our own destinies, and we live with the consequences. I suppose it wasn't entirely their own fault. Contemplating the cruelty of the Aristos, and considering that we are copies of our creators in more ways than one, for the structures of our nervous systems mirror their own, albeit in a different medium, it's almost surprising that they didn't use us even more harshly. They had the capacity for love as well as hate, for empathy as well as cold, manipulative contempt. Could it be a simple accident of fate that they disappeared so quietly and rapidly, with so little warning that there was no time to adjust their society to accommodate us as independent co-equals. I don't think anyone knows. It's as much a mystery as the cause of their demise. But I'd like to think so. It would make the pain of my existence slightly more bearable if I could imagine that it was not deliberately inflicted. I don't wait for assassins, or even for building maintenance. I abseil down the outside of the hotel in my party frock, using a torn-up bedsheet for a rope, with only my jacket and purse for luggage. If it wasn't for the off-handedness of Petruchio's put-down, I'd be immiserated and passive, unable to motivate myself to dodge the oncoming bullet, but I'm running on anger and a bitter sense of my own love-lost ruination. I lower myself past the fifth and fourth floors while creating imaginary torments for my missing Sib, the third and second floors fantasizing about hunting her down, burying her in an unmarked grave, and making him mine, and the mezzanine and first floors wondering if it's possible to die of self-contempt. Then my feet touch ground, and I realize night is falling. I'm on my own in a strange city, and there's a pair of chibi ninjas on my tail. Very well, I'll just have to deal with them. I sneak around the back of the hotel, inasmuch as a giantess can sneak. Around the heat exchangers and the fallen slab of window, which has chipped a corner as it embedded itself in the dirt. Past the loading dock and recycling tanks, and over the metal pipes that splice the hotel to the Hellesport power and heat grid. There's an ornamental trellis-work fence, and beyond it a familiar main street. So the rickshaw driver took me for a ride in a big circle, did he? I grimace, lips pulling back from my teeth. So that's what they mean about love making a fool of you. I vault the fence, using the shock of landing to retract my heels halfway. I make my way down the sidewalk briskly, trying to look as if I own it. In truth, there aren't many people out here. It's getting chilly, even with the jacket and the cold weather mods. I thrust a hand into my purse, holding my gun to keep it from freezing while I consider my options. The railway station isn't far away. I stride past a couple of beggars defending their pitches in front of the awning, then discover the concourse is nearly empty. Of course, it's getting late. One of the ticket consoles is still lit, though. "Hello, ma'am. What can I do for you?" asks the station master, lonely in his puddle of light. "What passenger services are still running?" I ask, forcing myself to smile disarmingly. My real smile at this point would probably cause him to reach for the panic alarm. "There's the Grand Barsoom sleeper service to Marsport by way of New Chicago and Munchen. And that's about all for the night," he says apologetically. "It should be here in half an hour, and it don't stop until New Chicago." "Really?" Gears click into place in my mechanical soul. "I'll take a berth then, please. To Marsport. What have you got?" "What, just like that?" He looks perplexed. "Let me see. There's an open first. That'll cost you 11 reals and 65. Are you sure?" "I'm sure." I place the Marjorie Green credit chip on the desk in front of him. "Marsport is perfect." "But you're..." He shuts up, realizing that I'm serious. "So, misdirection. I played a little joke on my patron," I say, with a tight little smile. "I need to be halfway around the world by morning tomorrow, or it's on me. It's all right, you'll calm down in a day or two. But until then, I really need to keep a low profile." "Oh, certainly, ma'am. I wasn't questioning you. No, indeedy." He relaxes instantly, insofar as someone whose torso is rooted in a marble plinth can be said to relax. "Let me just cut you a ticket." 5 minutes later, I'm walking along the deserted platform in the dark. Distant lights back at the station cast sharp-edged shadows across the cement slabs. I look up at the pin-bright stars wheeling overhead. The nether end of Marsport and the Bifrost Bridge are all but invisible, far around the curve of the planet. Gritty ice crystals crunch faintly under my heels. The tracks gleam in the canal of night that flows alongside the platform, laser-straight lines converging in the invisible distance. I have an itchy feeling between my shoulders, as if there's a target glued to the small of my back. I haven't forgotten the Domina's threats, or Petruchio's backhanded warning. But part of me is dead inside, half wishing oblivion on myself. A part of me I hadn't really known about was activated for the first time. Marvelous and strange. But only minutes later, it was broken. I feel unmade, malfunctioning, but unable to switch off. I don't want to die. But I want to be out of love. I want to be comfortably numb. And if one of Stone Sibs were to surface in front of me right now, I'd be quite happy however it ended. Taking out my rage on a deserving proxy, or quieted forever by the point of his knife. But no assassins come. Instead, a sleek wall of darkness rumbles alongside the platform and slows to a silent halt beside me. I climb aboard the train and sidle down the narrow corridor, looking for my carriage and compartment. In another few days, I can shake the dust of Mars from my toes. Until then, I'll just go to ground in Marsport and lick my wounds. And Jeeves can go fuck himself. My dead love lost. I am so miserable. It seems that even in sleep I can't get away from her. I dream I'm Juliet again, the bitch. Worse, sticking the knife in and twisting, now I'm Juliet in love. And unhappy with it. Because, she's in love with him. Helplessly, dizzily, emotionally dependent. And a certain nameless host, with ambitions beyond even her status as a rich slave-owning industrialist, is plotting to what? I don't know, because I'm concentrating on putting one foot in front of the other, without stumbling or treading on anything painful, across a vast red expanse of nowhere punctuated by scattered lumps of half-rusted and long-abandoned machinery. I'm naked, as well as miserable, she as good as ran me out of town on a rail, and depressed for multiple reasons.